The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening again, and I'm delighted to be meditating with people in the same room. And for the last year and a half, I've delighted with sitting with people who were on the other side of the camera. And appreciate, and also who were, you know, see their names and greetings and chat. And that was quite lovely, but it's also very nice to be here with you all. Thank you for coming. And it's like a beginning of, hopefully a beginning that will continue now to develop, that we can open up and we can start gathering together as a community. So the idea is to for us to continue on Mondays, being open the way we are with people who have registered and signed up to come. And then Diana, who's been teaching this, holding down Mondays throughout the pandemic. Thank you, Diana. And the idea for the next while is that we'll alternate teaching here. So Diana will be here next Monday, and I'll be the following, and so on for a while. That's kind of the general plan. So, thinking about a talk for today, I thought that this is kind of a new beginning here, that I thought that a really good place to begin is with the Four Noble Truths. They're considered kind of a core teachings of the Buddha, and it seems pretty symbolic to start with that, pretty evocative for me to kind of start with. As they say that all of the Buddha's teachings can be subsumed or held within the Four Noble Truths. The ancient analogy that comes from India, just like all the animals in the forest, their footprints can be held inside the footprint of an elephant. This is big enough to hold it all. So the Four Noble Truths are big enough to hold it all. And down through the ages, there's been many understandings or interpretations of the Four Noble Truths. And there isn't like a singular understanding. In fact, the Buddha suggested that. He said there are innumerable explanations for these Four Noble Truths. So they're very rich and evocative. And rather than taking them as being a singular thing, that there's only one thing, we learn the basic idea of it, and then we learn to apply it to ourselves and to our lives and discover, you know, how it means for us. There's a Mahayana Buddhist teaching that in this universe of ours, there's lots and lots of kind of world systems with people who live on planets all over the cosmos. And all of them have the Four Noble Truths. And then they go through a long list of how they talk about the Four Noble Truths in all these different world systems. It's like a long, long, long text. And it's mostly just a list of all the different formulations of these four that could exist. And so this idea that there's many. So I'll offer you, you know, one of them, which is based on the early Buddhist tradition. And you'll see if it's nice for you. And as introduction to it, if you say you rent an apartment someplace, and you date to move in, and everything in the apartment is all good, except in the corner of the living room, there's an old radio that's really grimy. Someone must have spilled food on it long ago, and it's not very nice, but you know, someone forgot it or left it. You're curious. You say, oh, what's that doing here? And but the thing is, it's on, and it's on some really kind of radio station you'd never want to listen to, and it's on, and so you look at it and say, wow, this is not right, and maybe you get angry at the people who were there before, or maybe you feel like you write a self-righteous letter to the landlords and say, you know, this radio was left here and it's a real problem. Or Maybe you should go out and buy a bigger radio to put in front of it to hide it. Or maybe you should find another apartment, or all these thoughts. And that goes on for days and weeks, you know, trying to figure out what to do about this radio that's on all the time. And then one day you finally decide, you realize, you know, I could just turn the radio off. And you don't, at least you don't have to hear that terrible radio station all the time. So it's possible to see all kinds of things wrong in our world, in our society, or with ourselves, and miss that there's a little button where certain things can be turned off. And maybe that's a little bit too dramatic of a story, analogy, but maybe it's worth kind of preparing for what I'm going to say. That what we're looking for in the Four Noble Truths, we're looking for, trying to understand ourselves, to see what we can do to stop suffering, to turn off the button of our suffering. And to do that, we have to understand our contribution to it. What are we doing to contribute to the radio being on? And where can we turn it off? And there's lots of things that are wrong with having the radio there, and they left it there, and it's dirty, they didn't clean, and it's the wrong station, and, you know, what was the landlord thinking, and you paid a deposit, and this is what you get. So you can do all those things, but the radio still blares, and you can turn it off. The fact that you weren't treated nicely or respectfully by the previous tenants or someone may be still true, not to be denied. But if you want to sleep at night, you want to turn the radio off. So the Four Noble Truths are a means, it's like a little description of four steps or four areas by which we can understand our life to help us understand what is our contribution to our suffering, to our distress. What are we doing that's adding to it? Not to diminish, you know, necessarily taking care of things in the world, but what is our contribution? And because your contribution to your suffering, that you have some ability to do something about. Whether you can change the world around you is maybe you can, maybe you can't. And some people will spend an inordinate amount of time trying to change the world around them, changing their family, changing their work, their boss, their co-workers, their friends, trying to get them all to behave just right, and their neighbors or whatever. And sometimes the track record, the success record of changing the world to accommodate ourselves and make it all right is not so high. And it isn't that it shouldn't be done, but if it overlooks where we can make a difference, it's a little bit sad. And so the art of it all is to look, where can I make a difference? Where can I change something? And this has to do what I call our contribution to our suffering. And so the schema of the four are offering perspectives to get us in the territory so we can begin understanding what our contribution is. So the four are, the first one is a very simple, and it just says that it's the noble truth of suffering. That's how it's translated into English. The ancient language, Buddhist language, the word suffering literally means painful. And so it's saying that there is what is painful. There are painful things in this world. But it's what we're looking at now is where the suffering is. So where is the emotional pain? What's painful emotionally? Where's the distress? And the second noble truth is stated very simply. It's the arising of this painful thing. The arising of this suffering. The third is the cessation of it, the ending of it. And the fourth is that there is a way to the ending of that suffering. The middle two, the arising and the ceasing, are it's a very important to see Because this is where we understand that our suffering is not hardwired in. It's not like we're born with this suffering and therefore we can't do anything about it. It's something that comes and goes. It appears and disappears. It might seem like it's constant and seem like it's solid and unchanging, but in fact, in its essence or something, in its own nature, it's actually something that's arising and passing and coming and going. And that's the good news. Because if it was solid and unchanging, then there's no hope. But if it's something that comes and goes, then we have some possibility to do something about it. We have some possibility to find it another way. So the first noble truth is just an acknowledgement that things are painful. And all kinds of things are painful. The list that the classic texts give are things like birth is painful, old age is painful, sickness is painful, separation from our loved ones is painful, not being separate from the people who are difficult is painful. There's all these things that are painful. So there's acknowledgement, yes, there is this pain in the world. But the second noble truth says, and then what is the suffering that is arising that appears in you? And that's the idea of your contribution. Where is the suffering that appears within you that has its genesis in what you're doing? Or where you left the radio on? What is it? What is that? And then the text points to that it has to do with the suffering that you can do most about is a suffering that is craving. And the word is usually called, it's usually the classic, the original word is thirst, which is meant kind of like a thirst for power or something, this drive or this compulsion by which people are not free. We're so driven by something that we have to have it. And this drivenness that where we can't put something down, or we can't stop what we're behaving, is the genesis of what's this, the suffering that we can do something about. That's where we contribute to our own suffering. So that's what we want to understand. We want to understand the craving, the thirst, the drive, not only because it brings about suffering, but it is suffering. It's painful to be caught in the grip of craving, of thirst, of things you can't put down. And I think meditators have developed a pretty good sense of this, because it's one thing to kind of just go about your day and feel like you can't put something down. But to sit and meditate and you see the mind just kind of churning away with its preoccupations, concerns, and drives, wow, this is powerful. This is suffering. Sometimes the promise of getting what we want, the imagination of it, hides that it's actually distressing and uncomfortable to be under the yoke of compulsion, of craving. But it's hard to see it if you're focusing so much on the thing you're going to get. If I only win the California lottery, I have to win the California lottery, then everything's going to be okay. And I can just imagine, I'm going to build a swimming pool if I get a California lottery. And it'd be so great, with three temperatures. And it'd be so great. But you don't see that drive maybe is a kind of desperation. It kind of comes out of maybe loneliness or even fear or insecurity, all kinds of things that it comes with. As we meditate, we start seeing this. And at some point we see that it's not solid. It's not fixed. It's something that is porous, something that's inconstant, something that comes and goes. But in order to see that, we have to be somewhat quiet and gathered and collected and have the ability to really see. And that's why one of the functions of meditation is not to sit down and right away just see what's going on and have insight in some deep way. But meditation is partly to settle us enough, quiet us enough, just enough, not dramatically, but enough so we can really start seeing that the porousness of our suffering, the inconstancy of it, the coming and going of it, and as we see that more and more, we see that there is possible to be without it. It is possible to bring it to an end, that it can cease. And because we taste that very fleetingly, perhaps, but we say, "Wow, I've had this resentment for 2 years, and I thought it was solid. It's like a mood that I carry around with me everywhere. But now I see there's flickers of times when it's not there. Wow, it's not always there." And in the Buddhist practice, the idea is to appreciate those flickers, appreciate those moments it's not there. And that can be hard to do because an absence like that doesn't count for much. And because the drive, the craving, the wanting, the ideas, the stories we tell ourselves come so quickly that they override the flickering moment of peace. The flickering moment of there's something what got quiet and wasn't there. It's not like these waves that come and they come, and because they come so much, we don't see the small little gaps, small little pieces go on. But as we start this meditation practice, then at some point we start seeing there are gaps. It's porous. It's not so solid. It's not so constant as I thought. And it can give a lot of hope. A tremendous amount of inspiration comes then. Oh, there's another way. And at some point, those little gaps, those flickers, begin showing us that we can be at peace. There's little peace here. There's a little bit of ease here. Even though it's only there a flicker, it's there. I know it's there. I feel it. Now the task is to begin to grow it, to recognize it more. And the task for doing that with mindfulness meditation is to just do the same thing over again. Just keep settling, keep looking, keeping present, but know where to look. If you're still writing letters to the landlord about the radio, you're looking in the wrong place. You won't see that there's a switch to turn it off. If you are... So you need to look, learn how to settle and turn the attention here to yourself. And I like to think of that as turning around to become intimate with yourself. Get really close and intimate. Get to know yourself well. Feel yourself. Sense yourself. Allow yourself to get collected and gather together. It's like a wonderful thing to do for yourself, to feel yourself gathering together, collecting, unified, where the mind and body and the heart are all operating together at the same time in the same place. And primarily that's the task of the mind, to come into the place where the body is, because the body is always in the present moment. And so the mind is often not. And so it's a task of the mind to come back here, be here. And it's possible to do that job of mindfulness, of gathering yourself together, it's possible to do it with lots of love, lots of care, lots of compassion, lots of generosity to oneself. That each of us counts, each of us is important, and so much, so important, so valuable, that it's worthwhile being here for yourself, gathering together, collecting yourself, settling here, becoming more embodied, more present, more yourself in a sense, in this process that begins quieting the mind, and the gaps become longer. The porousness gets bigger, and we start feeling more than just flickers of peace, of well-being, but becomes, moments. The moments become minutes, the minutes become hours, and they grow. So life is painful in all kinds of ways. Turn the attention to understand where that painfulness is here in yourself. And you'll notice that craving, attachments, clinging. There's a whole slew of words that Buddhism uses. Those movements, those activities are painful. And it's hard to appreciate that they're painful if we're too focused on what we're clinging to, what we want, or what we don't want. So the art of turning the attention 180 degrees around to feel and sense, hear, be with yourself, and feel, oh, this is where my contribution is to my suffering. This is what I'm adding, is that craving, that thirst, that resistance, that hatred. And we say, oh, that's what it is. And then we feel it, and then it's be with it, breathe with it, sense it, embody it in a certain way. Let the mind get quieter with it. And you start seeing its porous nature, its flickering nature, the gaps. You see that it rises, you see that it appears and it disappears. And one of the great moments in this whole process is that you're sitting around minding your own business, and maybe a thought of something you're very attached to arises. You can feel the attachment come along with the thought. But you didn't have it, and now it comes. And you see it. Wait a minute. You watched that happen. Wow. Look at that. It wasn't, and now it's come into existence. And you are wiser than it. You've now been watching it without identifying with it and being caught in it. You see it arise. There it is. And then you might also see that it's disappeared. And then if you're interested in that process, interested in extending those gaps, discovering more and more about how to bring this craving, clinging to an end, then you come to the fourth noble truth. And the fourth noble truth is the truth of the way to that cessation. Not just the small little gaps, but the really, you know, qualitatively significant way in which something really drops away. And the classic description of that is the Eightfold Path, which is a set of eight practices that are meant to encompass our whole life, all of our life. Because if you really want to make this Four Noble Truths the really deep, really thorough and complete, so not just flickers or momentary, it should be something that relates to how you live your whole life. So how you speak, how you act, what kind of work you do, how you live with your own mind, how you pay attention, how you be focused, what attitudes you have as you go through your life, and what understandings you have that through which you see how to behave and how to live in this life. So Eightfold Path is right view, right understanding, right, usually says right intention or right attitude, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And so to begin, to be inspired, maybe only if you're inspired, but inspired by this possibility of bringing the suffering to an end or make these flickers last longer, then it helps to create a bigger foundation to gather yourself together, to be collected and really show up for yourself and be here. And that's what the Eightfold Path is about, to live that Eightfold Path so that freedom is not just a flicker, but becomes, something that's more regular. In fact, that's what becomes constant at some point, the sense of the freedom from clinging, the freedom from this contribution we make. So a simple way of asking yourself this question is, what am I attached to right now? So if you're suffering, we ask, where am I attached right now? That's one of the questions that turns the attention around 180 degrees. And then not only what am I attached to, but where is the attachment? Where do I feel in my body, in my mind, in my heart, the contraction, the clinging, the tightness. That we can do something about. And if you, in the long term, learning to understand your contribution to your suffering and learning to end that contribution is the most reliable thing you can do in the Dharma. And it'll you learn it well, and it's phenomenal how it changes one's life. The confidence it gives, the ease it gives, the peace it gives, and the wisdom it gives for how to navigate and work this life and live this life. So we're interested in our contribution to our own suffering. And I think it's a very mature thing for a human being to take up that interest and really study that and look at it. And not enough people do it. Too many people, I think, are looking outside of themselves for how the world contributes to our suffering, which is certainly a worthwhile thing to do sometimes. But if that's the only thing we do, then we're going to live for a long, long time with that terrible radio station blaring. And it's nice to turn it off. So those are my thoughts for this beginning. And so there are other Dharma talks to be given on the Four Noble Truths that are possible, and other interpretations, other takes on them. But that's what was here today. Hopefully it was a fit for you, to give you something to think about and orientation. So thank you very, very much. And I look forward to seeing you more. And I know all of you that are here. So it's I've seen you before, and it's very nice to have you back and be together after all this time. And thank you so much. And for those of you on YouTube, thank you very much for being part of this. And I look forward to having this chance to do this with you again. Thank you.